firmly fixed on the doorway, and ears strained for the rattle of the trolley, which would herald the arrival of the new girl and, of course, 107 types of cheese and more than 70 different varieties of pickles, chutneys and other tracklements. The new girl might be the very paradigm of beauty, but UU was not the place for a man who could forget his cheeses. Well, she was a distraction, at least, Ponder thought as he snapped the book shut, and the university needed a few of them right now. It had been tricky since the dean had left. Very tricky indeed. Whoever heard of a man resigning from UU? It was something that simply did not happen. Sometimes people left in disgrace, in a box, or, in a few cases, in bits, but there was no tradition of resigning at all. Tenure at unseen university was for life, and often a long way beyond. The office of Master of the Traditions had fallen inevitably on Ponder Stibbons, who tended to get all the jobs that required someone who thought that things should happen on time and that numbers should add up. Regrettably, when he'd gone to check on things with the previous Master of the Traditions, who, everyone agreed, had not been seen around and about lately, he'd found that the man had been dead for 200 years. This wasn't a wholly unusual circumstance. Ponder, after years at Unseen, still didn't know the full size of the faculty. How could you keep track of them in a place like this these days, where hundreds of studies all shared one window, but only on the outside? Or rooms drifted away from their doorways during the night, travelled intangibly through the slumbering halls, and ended up docking quite elsewhere? A wizard could do what he liked in his own study, and in the old days that had largely meant smoking anything he fancied, and farting hugely without apologising. These days, it meant building out into a congruent set of dimensions. Even the Arch-Chancellor was doing it, which made it hard for Ponder to protest. He had half a mile of trout stream in his bathroom, and claimed that messing about in his study was what kept a wizard out of mischief. And, as everyone knew, it did. It generally got him into trouble instead. Ponder had let that go, because he now saw it as his mission in life to stoke the fires that kept Mustrum Ridcully bubbling and made the university a happy place. As a dog reflects the mood of its owner, so a university reflects its Arch-Chancellor. All he could do now, as the university's sole, self-confessed, entirely sensible person, was to steer things as best he could, keep away from squalls involving the person previously known as the Dean, and find ways of keeping the Arch-Chancellor too occupied to get under Ponder's feet. Ponder was about to put the Book of Traditions away when the heavy pages flopped over. "That's odd."
"Oh, those old bookbindings get very stiff," said Ridcully. "They have a life of their own sometimes."
"Has anyone heard of Professor H.F. Pullunder or Dr. Eratimus?" The faculty stopped watching the door and looked at one another.
"Ring a bell, anyone?" said Ridcully. "Naughty tinkle," said the lecturer in recent runes cheerfully.
The Arch-Chancellor turned to his left.
"What about you, Dean? You know all the old..."
Ponder groaned. The rest of the wizards shut their eyes and braced themselves. This might be bad. Ridcully stared down at two empty chairs, with the imprint of a buttock in each one. One or two of the faculty pulled their hats down over their faces. It had been 2 weeks now, and it had not got any better. He took a deep breath and roared,
"Traitor!"
which was a terrible thing to say to two dimples in leather. The chair of indefinite studies gave Ponder Stibbons a nudge, indicating that he was the chosen sacrifice for today, again. Again.
"Just for a handful of silver he left us," said Ridcully to the universe in general.
Ponder cleared his throat. He'd really hoped the megapode hunt would take the Arch-Chancellor's mind off the subject, but Ridcully's mind kept on swinging back to the absent dean, the way a tongue plunges back to the site of a missing tooth.
In point of fact, I believe his remuneration is at least..." he began,
but in Ridcully's current mood, no answer would be the right one.
"Remuneration? Since when did a wizard work for wages? We are pure academics, Mr. Stibbons. We do not care for mere money."
Unfortunately, Ponder was a clear, logical thinker who, in times of mental confusion, fell back on reason and honesty, which, when dealing with an angry Arch-Chancellor, were, to use the proper academic term, unhelpful. And he neglected to think strategically, always a mistake when talking to fellow academics, and as a result made the mistake of employing, as at this point,
common sense. "That's because we never actually pay for anything very much," he said. "And if anyone needs any petty cash, they just help themselves from the big jar."
"We are part of the very fabric of the university, Mr. Stibbons. We take only what we require. We do not seek wealth, and most certainly we do not accept a post of vital importance which includes an attractive package of remuneration, whatever the hells that means, and other benefits including a generous pension." "A pension, mark you. Whenever has a wizard retired?"
"Well, Dr. Earwig," Ponder began, unable to stop himself.
"He left to get married," snapped Ridcully. "That's not retiring, that's the same as dying."
"What about Dr. Housemartin?" Ponder went on. The lecturer in recent runes kicked him on the ankle, but Ponder merely said, "Ouch," and continued, "He left with a bad case of work-related frogs, sir."
"If you can't stand her, he'd get off the pot," muttered Ridcully.
Things were subsiding a bit now, and the pointy hats were tentatively raised. The Arch-Chancellor's little moments only lasted a few minutes. This would have been more comforting were it not for the fact that at approximately 5-minute intervals, something suddenly reminded him of what he considered to be the Dean's totally treasonable activity, to wit, applying for and getting a job at another university via a common advertisement in a newspaper. That was not how a prince of magic behaved. He didn't sit in front of a panel of drapers, greengrocers and bootmakers. Wonderful people though they may be, salt of the earth no doubt, but even so, to be judged and assessed like some champion terrier, had his teeth counted, no doubt. He'd let down the entire brotherhood of wizardry. That's what he'd done. There was a squeaking of wheels out in the corridor, and every wizard stiffened in anticipation. The door swung open, and the first overloaded trolley was pushed in. There was a series of sighs as every eye focused on the maid who was pushing it, and then some rather louder sighs when they realised that she was not, as it were, the intended. She wasn't ugly. She might be called homely, perhaps, but it was quite a nice home, clean and decent, with roses round the door and a welcome on the mat and an apple pie in the oven. But the thoughts of the wizards were, astonishingly, not on food at this point, although some of them were still a bit hazy as to why not. She was, in fact, quite a pleasant-looking girl, even if her bosom had clearly been intended for a girl 2 feet taller. But she was not her. The egregious professor of grammar and usage would have corrected this to "she was not she," which would have caused the professor of logic to spit out his drink. The faculty was crestfallen, but it brightened up considerably as the caravan of trolleys wound its way into the room. There was nothing like a 3 a.m. snack to raise the spirits, everyone knew that. Well, Ponder thought, at least we've got through the evening without anything breaking. Better than Tuesday, at least. It is a well-known fact in any organisation that, if you want a job done, you should give it to someone who is already very busy. It has been the cause of a number of homicides, and in one case the death of a senior director from having his head shut repeatedly in quite a small filing cabinet. In UU, Ponder Stibbons was that busy man. He had come to enjoy it. For one thing, most of the jobs he was asked to do did not need doing, and most of the senior wizards did not care if they were not done, provided they were not done by themselves. Besides, Ponder was very good at thinking up efficient little systems to save time, and was, in particular, very proud of his system for writing the minutes of meetings, which he devised with the help of HEX, the university's increasingly useful thinking engine. A detailed analysis of past minutes, coupled with HEX's enormous predictive abilities, meant that for a simple range of easily accessible givens, such as the agenda, which Ponder controlled in any case, the committee members, the time since breakfast, the time to dinner, and so on, in most cases the minutes could be written beforehand. All in all, he considered that he was doing his bit in maintaining UU in its self-chosen course of amiable dynamic stagnation. It was always a rewarding effort, knowing the alternative, to keep things that way. But a page that turns itself was, to Ponder, an anomaly. Now, while the sound of the pre-breakfast supper grew around him, he smoothed out the page and read carefully. Glenda would have cheerfully broken a plate over Juliet's sweet, empty head when the girl finally turned up in the night kitchen. At least, she would cheerfully have thought about it in quite a deliberate way, but there was no point in losing her temper because its target was not really much good at noticing what other people were thinking. There wasn't a nasty bone in Juliet's body. It's just that she had a great deal of trouble homing in on the idea that someone was trying to be unpleasant to her. So Glenda made do with, "Where have you been? I told Mrs. Whitlow you'd gone home ill. Your dad'll be worried sick, and it looks bad to the other girls." Juliet slumped into a chair with a movement so graceful that it seemed to sing.
"Went to the football, didn't I? You know, we were playing those buggers in Dimwell."
"Until 3 in the morning?"
"That's the rules, isn't it? Play until full time, first dead man or first score."
"Who won?"
"Dunno."
"You don't know?"
"When we left, it was being decided on head wounds. Anyway, I went with Rotten Johnny, didn't I?"
"I thought you'd broken up with him."
"He brought me supper, didn't he?"
"You shouldn't have gone. That's not the sort of thing you should do."
"Like you know,"
said Juliet, who sometimes thought that questions were answers. "Just do the washing up, will you?" said Glenda. "And I'll have to do it again after you," she thought, as her best friend drifted over to the line of big stone sinks. Juliet didn't exactly wash dishes. She gave them a light baptism. Wizards weren't the type of people who noticed yesterday's dried egg on the plate, but Mrs. Whitlow could see it from 2 rooms away. Glenda liked Juliet. She really did, although sometimes she wondered why. Of course, they'd grown up together, but it had always amazed her that Juliet, who was so beautiful that boys went nervous and occasionally fainted as she passed, could be so, well, dumb about everything. In fact, it was Glenda who had grown up. She wasn't sure about Juliet. Sometimes it seemed to Glenda that she had done the growing up for both of them. "Look, you just have to scrub a bit, that's all," she snapped after a few seconds of listless dipping, and took the brush out of Juliet's perfect hand. And then, as the grease was sent down the drain, she thought, "I've done it again. Actually, I've done it again, again. How many times is that? I even used to play with her dolls for her." Plate after plate sparkled under Glenda's hands. Nothing cleans stubborn stains like suppressed anger. "Rotten Johnny," she thought. "Ye gods, he smells of cat wee. He's the only boy stupid enough to think he's got a chance. Good grief. She's got a figure like that, and all she ever dates are total knobheads. What would she do without me?" After this brief excitement, the night kitchen settled into its routine, and those who had been referred to as the other girls got on with their familiar tasks. It has to be said that girlhood for most of them had ended a long time previously, but they were good workers, and Glenda was proud of them. Mrs. Hedges ran the cheese boards like a champion. Mildred and Rachel, known officially on the payroll as the vegetable women, were good and reliable. And indeed, it was Mildred who had come up with the famous recipe for beetroot and cream cheese sandwiches. Everybody knew their job. Everybody did their job. The night kitchen was reliable, and Glenda liked reliable. She had a home to go to and made sure she went to it at least once a day, but the night kitchen was where she lived. It was her fortress. Ponder Stibbons stared at the page in front of him, his mind filled up with nasty questions, the biggest and nastiest of which was simply, "Is there any way at all in which people can make out that this is my fault?" "No." "Good."
"There is one tradition here that, regrettably, we don't appear to have honoured for some considerable time, Arch-Chancellor," he said, managing to keep the concern out of his voice.
"Well, does that matter?" said Ridcully, stretching.
"It is traditional, Arch-Chancellor," said Ponder reproachfully, "although I might go so far as to say that not observing it has now, alas, become the tradition."
"Well, that's fine, isn't it?" said Ridcully. "If we can make a tradition of not observing another tradition, then that's doubly traditional, eh? What's the problem?"
"It's Arch-Chancellor Preserved Bigger's Bequest," said the Master of the Traditions. "The university does very well out of the Bigger estates. They were a very rich family."
Yes. Name rings a faint bell. Decent of him. So?"
I would have been happier had my predecessor paid a little more attention to some of the traditions," said Ponder, who believed in drip-feeding bad news.
"Well, he was dead."
"Yes, of course. Perhaps, sir, we should start a tradition of checking on the health of the Master of the Traditions?"
"Oh, he was quite healthy," said the Arch-Chancellor. "Just dead. Quite healthy for a dead man."
"He was a pile of dust, Arch-Chancellor."
"That's not the same as being ill, exactly," said Ridcully, who believed in never giving in. "Broadly speaking, it's stable."
Ponder said,
"There is a condition attached to the bequest. It's in the small print, sir."
"No, I never bother with small print, Stibbons."
"I do, sir. It says, 'And this shall follow as long as the university shall enter a team in the game of foot the ball
or Poori Boys Funny.
Poori Boys Funny, said the Chair of Indefinite Studies. That's ridiculous, said Ridcully.
Ridiculous or not, Arch-Chancellor, that is the condition of the bequest.
But we stopped taking part in that years ago, said Ridcully. Mobs in the streets, kicking and punching and yelling. And they were the players. Mark you, the spectators were nearly as bad. There were hundreds of men in a team. A game could go on for days. That's why it was stopped.
Actually, it has never been stopped as such, Arch-Chancellor, said the senior wrangler. We stopped, yes, and so did the guilds. It was no longer a game for gentlemen.
Nevertheless, said the Master of the Traditions, running a finger down the page, such are the terms. There are all sorts of other conditions. Oh, dear. Oh, calamity. Oh, surely not. His lips moved silently as he read on. The room craned as one neck.
Well, out with it, man, roared Ridcully.
I think I'd like to check a few things, said the Master of the Traditions. I would not wish to worry you unduly. He glanced down.
Oh, hell's bells. What are you talking about, man?
Well, it looks as though... No, it would be unfair to spoil your evening, Arch-Chancellor, Ponder protested. I must be reading this wrongly. He surely can't mean... Oh, good heavens.
In a nutshell, please, Stibbons, growled Ridcully. I believe I am the Arch-Chancellor of this university. I'm sure it says so on my door.
Of course, Arch-Chancellor, but it would be quite wrong of me to...
I appreciate that you do not wish to spoil my evening, sir, said Ridcully, but I would not hesitate to spoil your day tomorrow. With that in mind, what the hell's are you talking about?
It would appear, Arch-Chancellor, that, when was the last game we took part in, do you know?
Anyone? Said Ridcully to the room in general. A mumbled discussion produced a consensus on the theme of around 20 years, give or take.
Give or take what, exactly? Said Ponder, who hated this kind of thing.
Oh, you know, something of that order, in the general vicinity of, so to speak. Round about then, you know.
About? Said Ponder. Can we be more precise?
Why?
Because... If the university hasn't played in the poor boy's fun for a period of 20 years or more, the bequest reverts to any surviving relatives of Arch-Chancellor Bigger.
But it's banned, man, the Arch-Chancellor insisted.
Not as such. It's common knowledge that Lord Vetinari doesn't like it, but I understand that if the games are outside the city centre and confined to the back streets, the watch turns a blind eye. Since... I would imagine that the supporters and players easily outnumber the entire watch payroll. I suppose it is better than having to turn a broken nose.
That's quite a neat turn of phrase there, Mr. Stibbons, said Ridcully. I'm quite surprised at you.
Thank you, Arch-Chancellor, said Ponder. He had, in fact, got it from a leader in the Times, which the wizards did not like much because it either did not print what they said or printed what they said with embarrassing accuracy. Emboldened, he added, I should point out, though, that under UU law, Arch-Chancellor, a ban doesn't matter. Wizards are not supposed to take notice of such a ban. We are not subject to mundane law.
Of course, but nevertheless it's generally convenient to acknowledge the civil power, said Ridcully,
speaking like a man choosing his words with such care that he was metaphorically taking some of them outside to look at them more closely in daylight. The wizards nodded. What they had heard was, Vetinari may have his little foibles, but he's the sanest man we've had on the throne in centuries. He leaves us alone, and you never know what he's got up his sleeve. You couldn't argue with that.
All right, Stibbons, what do you suggest? Said Ridcully. These days you only ever tell me about a problem when you've thought of a solution. I respect this, although I find it a bit creepy. Got a way to wriggle us out of this, have you?
I suppose so, sir. I thought we might, well, put up a team. It doesn't say anything about winning, sir. We just have to play, that's all. It was always beautifully warm in the candle vats. Regrettably, it was also extremely humid and rather noisy in an erratic and unexpected way. This was because the giant pipes of Unseen University's central heating and hot water system passed overhead, slung from the ceiling on a series of metal straps with a greater or lesser coefficient of linear expansion. That was only the start, however. There were also the huge pipes for balancing the slewed differential across the university, the pipe for the anthropic particle flux suppressor, which did not work properly these days, the pipes for the air circulation, which had not worked either since the donkey had been ill,
and the very ancient tubes that were all that remained of the ill-fated attempt by a previous Arch-Chancellor to operate a university communication system by means of trained marmosets. At certain times of the day, all this piping broke into a subterranean symphony of gurgles, twangs, upsetting organic trickling sounds, and occasionally an inexplicable boinging noise that would reverberate through the cellar levels. The general ad hoc nature of the system's construction was enhanced by the fact that, as an economy measure, the big iron hot water pipes were lagged with old clothing held on by string. Since some of these items had once been wizards' apparel, and however hard you scrubbed you could never get all of the spells out, there were sporadic showers of multicoloured sparks and the occasional ping-pong ball. Despite everything, Nut felt at home down among the vats. It was worrying. In the high country, people in the street had jeered at him that he'd been made in a vat. Although Brother Oates had told him this was silly, the gently bubbling tallow called to him. He felt at peace here. He ran the vats now. Smeems didn't know, because he hardly ever troubled to come down here. Trev knew, of course, but since Nut doing his job for him meant he could spend more time kicking a tin can around on some bit of waste ground, he was happy. The opinion of the other dribblers and dippers didn't really count. If you worked in the vats, it meant that, as far as the job market was concerned, you had been still accelerating when you'd hit the bottom of the barrel and had been drilled into the bedrock. It meant that you no longer had enough charisma to be a beggar. It meant that you were on the run from something, possibly the gods themselves, or the demons inside you. It meant that if you dared to look up, you would see, high above you, the dregs of society. Best, then, to stay down here in the warm gloom, with enough to eat and no inconvenient encounters, and, Nut added in his head, no beatings. No, the dippers were no problem. He did his best for them when he could. Life itself had beaten them so hard that they had no strength left to beat up anyone else. That was helpful. When people found out that you were a goblin, all you could expect was trouble. He remembered what the people in the villages had shouted at him when he was small, and the word would be followed by a stone. Goblin. It was a word with an ox trainload of baggage. It didn't matter what you said or did or made, the train ran right over you. He'd shown them the things he'd built, and the stones had smashed them while the villagers screamed at him like hunting hawks and shouted more words. That had stopped on the day Pastor Oates rode gently into town, if a bunch of hovels and one street of stamped mud could be called a town, and he had brought forgiveness. But on that day, no one had wanted to be forgiven. In the darkness, Concrete the Troll, who was so gooned out on slab, slice, sleek and slump, and who would even snort iron filings if Nut didn't stop him, whimpered on his mattress. Nut lit a fresh candle and wound up his homemade dribbling aid. It whirred away happily and made the flame go horizontal. He paid attention to his work. A good dribbler never turned the candle when he dribbled. Candles in the wild, as it were, almost never dripped in more than one direction, which was away from the draught. No wonder the wizards liked the ones he made. There was something disconcerting about a candle that appeared to have dribbled in every direction at once. It could put a man off his stroke. Employing professional dribblers might seem extravagant for a body like Unseen University. Nothing could be further from the truth. No traditional wizard worth his pointy hat could possibly work by the light of pure, smooth, dare one say, virgin, undribbled candles. It would just not look right. The ambiance would be totally shattered, and when it did happen, the luckless wizard would mess about, as people do, with matchsticks and bent paperclips, to try and get nice little dribbles and channels of wax as nature intended. However, this sort of thing never really works, and invariably ends with wax all over the carpet and the wizard setting himself on fire. Candle dribbling, it has been decreed, is a job for a dribbler. He worked fast, and was putting the 19th well-dribbled candle in the delivery basket when he heard the clank of a tin can being bowled along the stone floor of the passage. "Good morning, Mr. Trev," he said, without looking up. A moment later, an empty tin can landed in front of him, on end, with no more ceremony than a jigsaw piece falling into place.
"How did you know it's me, Gobbo?"
"Your leitmotif, Mr. Trev, and I'd prefer Nut, thank you."
"What's one of them motifs?" said the voice behind him.
"It is a repeated theme or chord associated with a particular person or place, Mr. Trev," said Nut, carefully placing two more warm candles in the basket. "I was referring to your love of kicking a tin can about. You seem in good spirits, sir. How went the day?"
"You what?"
"Did fortune favour Dimwell last night?"
"What are you on about?"
Nut pulled back further. It could be dangerous not to fit in, not to be helpful, not to be careful.
"Did you win, sir?"
"Nah, another no-score draw. Waste of time, really. But it was only a friendly. Nobody died."
Trev looked at the full baskets of realistically dribbled candles.
"That's a shitload you've done there, kid," he said kindly.
Nut hesitated again, and then said, very carefully,
"Despite the scatological reference, you approve of the large but unspecified number of candles that I've dribbled for you?"
"Blimey, what was all that about, Gobbo?"
Frantically, Nut sought for an acceptable translation.
"I done okay," he ventured.
Trev slapped him on the back.
"Yeah, good job. Respect. But you've got to learn to speak more proper, you know. You won't last 5 minutes down our way, you'd probably get half brick heaved at you."
"That has, I mean, as, been known to happen," said Nut, concentrating.
"I never seen why people make such a to-do," said Trev generously. "So there was all those big battles. So what? It was a long time ago and a long way away, right? And it's not like the trolls and dwarfs weren't as bad as you lot, ain't I right? I mean, goblins, what's all that about? You lot just cut throats and nick stuff, right? That's practically civilised in some streets round here."
Probably, Nut thought. No one could have been neutral when the Dark War had engulfed Far Uberwald. Maybe there had been true evil there, but apparently the evil was, oddly enough, always on the other side. Perhaps it was contagious. Somehow, in all the confusing histories that had been sung or written, the goblins were down as nasty, cowardly little bastards who collected their own earwax and were always on the other side. Alas, when the time came to write their story down, his people hadn't even had a pencil. Smile at people. Like them. Be helpful. Accumulate worth. He liked Trev. He was good at liking people. When you clearly liked people, they were slightly more inclined to like you. Every little helped. Trev, though, seemed genuinely unfussed about history, and had recognised that having someone in the vats who not only did not try to eat the tallow, but also did most of his work for him, and, at that, did it better than he could be bothered to do it himself, was an asset worth protecting. Besides, he was congenitally lazy, except when it came to foot the ball, and bigotry took too much effort. Trev never made too much effort. Trev went through life on primrose paths.
"Master Smeems came looking for you," said Nut. "I sorted it all out."
"Tar," said Trev, and that was that.
No questions. He likes Trev. But the boy was standing there, just staring at him, as if trying to work him out.
"Tell you what," Trev said, "come on up to the night kitchen and we'll scrounge breakfast, okay?"
Oh, no, Mr. Trev," said Nut, almost dropping a candle. "I don't think, sorry, think, I ought to."
"Come on, who's going to know? And there's a fat girl up there who cooks great stuff. Best food you ever tasted."
Nut hesitated. Always agree. Always be helpful. Always be becoming. Never frighten anyone.
"I think I will come with you," he said.
There's a lot to be said for scrubbing a frying pan until you can see your face in it, especially if you've been entertaining ideas of gently tapping someone on the head with it. Glenda was not in the mood for Trev when he came up the stone steps, kissed her on the back of the neck and said, cheerfully,
"Hello, darling, what's hot tonight?"
"Nothing for the likes of you, Trevor Likely," she said, batting him away with the pan, "and you can keep your hands to yourself, thank you."
"Not been keeping something warm for your best man?"
Glenda sighed. "There's bubble and squeak in the warming oven, and don't say a word if anyone catches you," she said.
"Just the job for a man who's been working like a slave all night," said Trev,
patting her far too familiarly and heading for the ovens.
"You've been at the football," snapped Glenda. "You're always at the football. And what kind of working do you call that?"
The boy laughed, and she glared at his companion, who backed away quickly as though from armour-piercing eyes.
"And you boys ought to wash before you come up here," she went on,
glad of a target that didn't grin or blow kisses at her.
"This is a food preparation area."
Nut swallowed. This was the longest conversation he'd ever had with a female, apart from Ladyship and Miss Heelstether, and he hadn't even said anything.
"I assure you, I bath regularly," he protested. "But you're grey."
"Well, some people are black and some people are white," said Nut, almost in tears. Oh, why had he left the vats? It was nice and uncomplicated down there, and quiet, too, when concrete hadn't been on the ferrous oxide.